Tonight on the Newsmaker Hour, we hear from one of San Antonio's great young artists, Vincent Valdez. He has an exhibit currently on display at the McNay entitled America's Finest. Valdez walked McNay audience members through his career in an hour-long presentation last month. We'll hear from it later in the show. In addition, the husband and wife duo Mark and Angela Wally talk about the process creating their short film on Valdez's painting, John, a piece that took the artist nearly 2 years to finish. Vincent Valdez has been drawing and painting since he was very young. The now 35-year-old was recognized early as gifted, being noticed by local muralist Alex Rubio. He was given the opportunity to learn the craft of muraling with Rubio, and he went on to the Rhode Island School of Design when he graduated from Burbank High School. It was after graduating from there and returning home to San Antonio that the McNay Art Museum's Lyle Williams, curator of prints and drawings, heard about him. Williams was at the time putting together a show of contemporary drawings for the museum.
And the second I walked into his studio, not only did I know that a work of his would be included in that survey, but he had worked on some very large-scale charcoal drawings, and I also knew in seconds of seeing the work that I would have to do a show for him as well.
Now at 24, Valdez had become the youngest solo exhibitor in the history of the McNay.
You know, it was a very proud moment for me back in the day when I had that show. I mean, it was something that I probably could honestly say I had never dreamed of. It was 17 monumental charcoal drawings on paper. The smallest pieces were about 9 or 10 feet.
10 years later, he's back at the McNay with America's Finest.
Well, this exhibit is titled America's Finest. It opened in late September of 2012. It's my most recent works to date.
Valdez is walking me through his latest exhibit. The exhibit focuses on soldiers and fighters, the link being the fact that all the pieces, again, examine classic masculine figures, but this focuses on the after effects, the struggles that come with what's left behind.
And I think that it's something, for me again as an artist, it's very important to get these images out because, you know, I tend to see a real sort of absence of these images in the contemporary art world, in mainstream media.
One piece entitled In Memory hangs in stark contrast to the rest. Valdez's usual style of hyper-realism is nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and it looks a lot different, you know, based off of, this is titled In Memory. This is such a different approach and style because it's my first collaboration with my fiancée, Adriana Corral. From far, from a distance, it appears just as a sort of black static. When you go up to it almost and put your nose up to the surface, you'll start to recognize that the static is made up of about 5,300 names that are stacked one on top of the other very meticulously.
The over 5,000 names are the names of soldiers who have killed themselves since returning from combat, a subject that holds personal weight with Valdez, whose lifelong friend John Holt, also from San Antonio, took his own life after returning from a tour in Iraq. This event seems to have spurred Valdez to create many of these images. The painting, John, hangs nearby. The image of a soldier lost in the fog of war, symbolizing the war at home that many veterans experience.
This portrait took about almost approximately 2 years. It's now the longest painting that I've ever sort of struggled and worked on throughout my entire career, and it's for obvious reasons. And it really kind of took me the exact length of 2 years to really kind of find my own way with it and to make my peace with it.
This is the Newsmaker Hour, and we'll be right back.
This week on Texas Matters, who were the winners and losers in the 2012 general election? Many are saying Latino voters are among the winners after coming out strong and voting for Democrats in big numbers. Now Republicans are looking for ways to gain support from this growing important demographic. That's on Texas Matters, Sunday night at 9:30 on KSTX. 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Newsmaker Hour. I'm Paul Flav, and we're looking at the work of San Antonio artist Vincent Valdez. Before the break, we heard about his current exhibit, America's Finest, and one of its centerpieces, the work entitled John. The painting took 2 years for him to complete. And the process was all documented by local filmmakers Angela and Mark Wally of Wally Films. The two filmmakers released a film called Excerpts for John with the web-based art magazine Glasstire.com. It's the eighth they have done with Glasstire on local artists, and it is very good. The Wallys joined me in the studio last week to talk about their work and how they got started documenting the arts in town.
So initially, your intention wasn't specifically to document the arts.
No, I think ultimately the first objective was really just to become friends with the art community and sort of discover how they work. And I think there felt like there was a bit of a void maybe in how, just the realm of how artists were being documented and not really seeing so much of a documentation of that. And I think we felt like we wanted to step in and sort of fill that void and take on that objective of really showing San Antonio how artists work and what their stories were.
A void in San Antonio or a void in...
Maybe specifically, yeah, San Antonio. I guess we kind of felt like, you know, there was this need. I mean, specifically with Glass Tear, they were wanting us, you know, to kind of focus on San Antonio based. They're an organization that's based in Houston, and they had other, you know, filmmakers or videographers working in different areas of Texas. And, you know, I thought maybe San Antonio was a little bit underrepresented. And so, you know, I think that was really nice for us. And I think we just get really inspired by collaboration. I mean, that's how we work. And so bringing somebody else in, bringing an artist in and getting to see how they work and how they, you know, how they make work and how they see the world, I think is, you know, really exciting for us as filmmakers.
And what was the very specific goal with Vincent?
Well, when we met Vincent in his studio, he had several projects that he was working on, several different paintings, and he described his, you know, his painting he was working on with his friend John at the time. And I feel like the story that he told behind that specific painting was more important, or seemed to strike a chord with us, than the other paintings he was working on. It was so important to him.
So you knew right away when he was describing his work at the time?
Absolutely.
Which one?
Yeah, I think it was really exciting because initially, I think we knew that a lot of his work was sort of this mix of non-real and real elements and sort of creating a lot of characters. And I think for the first time, it seemed to us that his friend John was kind of the first real personal subject that he took on to paint. And so we felt like as a more personal subject matter to him, we knew we wanted to sort of get in deeper with that story.
You've had 8 documentaries. This is your 8th. How long does it usually take to make one of your documentaries?
It really varies. I think it, you know, maybe a month, 2 months. You know, they're very short times that we spend. And, you know, even that, it's a lot for a 3-minute documentary. We'll maybe have, you know, 5 hours of footage, just following the artist around, seeing what they're doing. And Vincent's really was something that we didn't anticipate needing so much time on. You know, we spent 2 years with him. And it wasn't as if we were going every weekend or, you know, we'd spend months apart and then come back to the studio to see where he was at. And so that was what was interesting, you know, kind of waiting to hear back from him. And knowing it was taking him a long time because of how personal and how, you know, difficult the subject matter was.
Did how you planned the documentary change as you maybe realized how invested he was?
I think so. I think, you know, when we started, we just thought it was essentially a film about a painting, you know, the one painting he was making. And, you know, towards the end of the work, when he was getting ready to install his show at the McNay, we realized that there was a lot of work that he had made also in response to the loss of his friend John. There was a lot of things that he was dealing with that he took time to think about through his work, and so we try to also touch on those other, you know, artworks as well. So it wasn't just about the painting, but that really was, I think, you know, what we wanted to focus the film on, because it did take him so long, you know, to complete that particular work.
The debut of the documentary was along with his lecture, was it not?
Yeah, we premiered it, and that was the first time even he had seen it. And it was really interesting because, you know, we had given him the script. He knew what he was saying. We'd kind of discussed a lot of the elements, and he kind of knew what to expect, but we hadn't really screened it for him beforehand. And so, you know, it was difficult, but I really felt like it was a very important moment when the film finished, and I realized that John's parents were sitting next to us and Vincent was sitting right behind us. And I realized, you know, this is just a film for us. We've made like 25 short films on artists, but there was something really powerful about this film that we really hadn't, you know, touched on in any of our other films.
And what was the response?
I think it was difficult for his parents. They maybe, you know, we weren't ready to meet them. Maybe they weren't ready to meet us. But I felt like, you know, later Vincent got in touch with us. And, you know, I think generally that they were very, very happy with the film And I think very happy that not only Vincent's artwork, but our film, you know, really was in memory of John and preserved his memory in that way.
What did Vincent think of the movie?
I think he was really happy with it. I think it was an extension of him feeling like it was part of this kind of closure for him in coping with this very hard to deal with kind of feeling while he was painting, and also to have us on board kind of documenting him, I'm sure must have been somewhat stressful too, but I think the finishing of the film was kind of in some ways sort of setting aside some of those feelings and sort of, you know, making him feel more comfortable with the final work.
Response at large, how's that been?
All of our work really is sort of put on Vimeo. Yeah, I think the film, it was picked up as sort of a Vimeo staff pick, and in that way it got a lot of exposure through that, and picked up on a few blogs that we've been sort of following and admiring of. So it's been really exciting for us to kind of use that internet stage as a very broad way of sharing our work.
Mm-hmm. Are you hoping to apply anything from the project to your next documentaries?
Absolutely. I feel like this film with Vincent really kind of opened us up to challenging how we approach making documentary films. The first scene in the film opens up with Vincent taking photographs of John wearing, you know, his friend John wearing this combat gear in this neighborhood on the south side of San Antonio. And, you know, people who first saw the film weren't totally sure if that was real or not, if that was really John or if that was someone we had play John. And it was actually a family member that we had play John. And I feel like it was important for us to visually retell that part of the story, and that's something that we hope to continue to do with our other films.
And that was exciting because it was really sort of an extension of Vincent's own input of sort of real and non-real elements in his own work. And I like that we sort of, took that on too in our own approach to this film, is combined this sort of memory that he had, this real memory, and sort of, you know, made it our own and sort of recreated elements of it.
Well, I appreciate you guys coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
That was Mark and Angela Wally of Wally Films. Their short film, Excerpts for John, showed today at the McNay and can be found on their website, wallyfilms.com. When we return, we hear Vincent Valdez walk us through his career in a presentation he did at the McNay last month. This is the Newsmaker Hour, and we'll be right back.
I'm Fred Child, the host of Performance Today on KPAC. If you like the weekend edition Sunday Puzzler, the Car Talk Puzzler, the news quiz from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, how about a music puzzler? Every Wednesday, composer Bruce Adolph plays a popular tune in the style of a great composer. See if you can guess the tune and the composer. The Piano Puzzler on American Public Media's Performance Today. Weekdays at 6 on KPAC, 88.3 FM, your classical oasis.
Welcome back to the Newsmaker Hour. Vincent Valdez's America's Finest is on display at the McNay, and here is the artist presenting on that exhibit and his career as a whole. This presentation was recorded as part of Texas Public Radio's Hear Essay program. It's been edited for time, but you can find the full presentation at tpr.org under the Hear Essay library.
All right, good evening. I'd like to start off by thanking each one of you for being here tonight. It's always a continuous honor and privilege to be here at the McNay to share my work and vision with the McNay and all of its great audiences that I have been able to interact with over the past 10 years or so. I was really excited about this evening for a number of different reasons. Number one, because it meant I was finally done with the show and I was a free man again. Number two, I really wanted to try something different in this presentation of slides. Instead of just sort of standing up here and talking directly about the exhibit that you see in America's Finest upstairs. I wanted to try to take a different approach and sort of put together an almost a chronological timeline, because I think it's necessary and important to sort of emphasize that I didn't just sort of wake up one morning and try to figure out a subject matter to portray in my work and think, oh, why not soldiers and boxers? You know, it sounds cool. I mean, this has literally been a lifetime spent at this point of just sort of thinking about these concepts and sort of branching them out into various other concepts and reevaluating them and experimenting with these things, analyzing these things. It's endless, you know, as a painter in the studio. And I can't believe that I have literally spent 35 years now almost literally working, doing the same thing that I was doing at 3 years old. So with that being said, I'll start breezing through these images. And I thought I'd start with this image here. This is my most recent, latest work in the studio. Finished last night. Just kidding. I rehearsed that one all week. But this is probably one of my earliest drawings, if it wasn't for my mother keeping all of these things in her closets and in boxes, she's my number one archivist, all of these things were probably and should have been disappeared by now. But the reason I decided to show this image, this early image, was because there's something that struck me when I found this a few years ago. Already there was this inclination to sort of portray the underdog, the outsiders, the idea of those sort of left behind or forgotten entirely, or those that, like the little black fish there, they're trying to find their own way and make their own paths in the world. I would say at an extremely early age, I encountered my first museum, and it was the little tiny South Side home of my grandparents. And their entire house was like a small mini museum in the Southside community with the works of my great-grandfather, who was a painter, a man that I never met, a man that is more sharply dressed than anyone else that I knew or have seen in photos, and I hear that he actually looked like that in the studio. And so all of his paintings were on exhibit in my grandparents' house. I remember very vividly sitting in this dark hallway and looking up at this small oil painting that he did, probably as a young man. It's dated 1884, 1888, somewhere around there. It's a beautiful piece. But this image for me, I remember staring up at it just in a gaze, in complete awe. And I couldn't understand it. It was a very violent, striking image. And I realized at that moment, you know, I literally remember staring at this piece and saying, I want to do that. There's something that was so haunting and something that was so evocative about this image. He was a great painter, and over the years, my grandparents have started to hand down some of these paintings to me. I cherish these paintings not only because they're by my great-grandfather, but because I see a lot of the similarities. I see, you know, it must be in the genes. There's these sorts of various viewpoints and takes on society, on culture, on social issues. Now, also at that young of an age, I encountered the stories from my grandfather and from my father about their experiences as young men at war. But I remember going into my grandparents' house, and my grandpa always had this treasure chest that was like the most interesting, surreal object that I had ever seen. I remember it smelled like wet mildew or wet blankets, but he always would pull out this old leather, it's almost deteriorated, old scrap photo book from World War II. When he was a young man, he would tell me these stories about how he was a bubble gunner underneath, a turret gunner underneath the B-17s, and how he knew he wouldn't make it out alive, and so he had to come up with a plan B. I remember very clearly the stories of my father telling me that what his experience was like when he walked home from Handy Andy, his high school job or his after-school job, and he received his draft notice in 1969, I believe. And this was sort of kind of an epiphany for me because, again, at age 5, age 6,
I should have been throwing rocks outside of my little brother or something. But I was more interested in, you know, very quickly in these sort of more complex stories that in my head were sort of, you know, there was all these questions. And I remember looking up to my dad and asking him as a kid, but why did you go? And he said, well, he responded, well, I had to. And I responded, but why? And he says, well, you just had to. You just, that's something you had to do. And I continued, it was sort of like this ping pong table. We were going back and forth. And I remember asking him, but if you didn't want to go, why didn't you just not go? Who can make you do something? And he said, well, the government. You know, he said that was, you know, we were called, you had to serve. But it set off this whole trigger of a chain reaction in my head, you know, in my young head. And I immediately went in and started portraying some of these things in the drawings. And you can see the real shift, you know, probably from within a few years from like age where, you know, around age 9, age 10, I was already trying to figure out and flesh out these stories. And I think that you can see the real shift of this idea from and of this analytical approach to what heroes are. So this idea of heroes such as these masculine heroes, these masculine icons, such as my grandfather here at 103 pounds with this million-dollar shot of him getting his front teeth knocked out, literally, barefoot. But there was already this very sort of complex approach, I think, on my part. You know, I was always asking these questions and sort of challenging these ideas and these notions of what mythologies and heroes were. And so when I first met Alex at the old Esperanza Peace and Justice Center, which is actually still standing, this mural, you know, the irony of my days as a muralist is that all of my murals that I did as a teenager up until my early 20s are completely, they're all gone. The only one that's ever survived is the very first one that I did. Alex tells this story about when he met me, he saw the drawing ability that I had in my little school folder that I handed to him, and he gave me my own wall. Now, I had never picked up a paintbrush, and he gave me a quick demo, and I was like a sponge. I mean, I just absorbed everything, every piece of information that he gave me, and he left me alone, which was probably the most crucial, important thing that he could have done. Alex came back about 3 hours later, and I had painted this scene of some people working in the fields, croppers. In the sky, you see these silhouettes of these fighter jets that are swooping down on them, about to drop napalm, and then it reads in the sky, "Make food, not war." After that mural, Alex hired me on as his apprentice, and we did so many different projects in the housing projects in the west side of San Antonio downtown, and it was golden. What a golden, invaluable education and experience like no other could ever come close, no other could ever top. Because for me, again, that exposure, that realization at an extremely early age that to have somebody in the flesh like Alex. Now, then something happened around 1990. It was this sort of second epiphany, this sort of wake-up call. And I'll never forget it and for several different reasons. My dad took the family to go see Platoon. It was very brutal scenes of warfare and this sort of harsh reality. I mean, I think at that point, you know, it was criticized for, but it was also praised for being one of the first films in response to the Vietnam War of what it actually was like, in contrast to the John Wayne films, right? That sort of John Wayne personification of war. The other thing that I realized during that film was I found myself halfway through the films staring at the audience more than I was the actual screen, because I had this sort of realization, this sort of, again, this sort of wake-up call. And I watched the audience intently, and I saw how they were in awe. It was complete silence, dead silence. And I thought, that's it. Like, that's what I need to do. That's what I want to do. The ability to capture an audience for more than 2 seconds, the ability to make an audience feel. So I ran home, and it seemed like all of the small drawings that I was doing at that point just changed forever. I was immediately engrossing myself in this idea of these harsh realities of these young men. So I found a book at the Collins Garden Public Library, probably in the fifth or sixth grade, And it was by this name I had never heard, a photographer named Larry Burroughs, who to me, to this day, you know, I completely hold up on a pedestal. To me, this guy, he had that eye. He knew what he was doing. He knew how to tap in not only to his subject but to his audience. And then fast forwarding to 20 years later, you know, I did this drawing about a year ago titled After You, Larry. And it was my first and only homage and tribute and gratitude to Larry Burroughs, a study of one of his portraits. I majored in illustration, and I thought that I wanted to do book covers and CD illustration, stuff like that. But then I figured out very quickly I didn't like the idea of somebody dictating to me what my subject matters were going to be or what my color was going to be. And probably when I was entering my senior year, you know, it was this real change of pace for me. And I feel like from this point on, the work really rapidly evolved. It really just sort of took off, even beyond my own handling. And I always felt like from this point on, I was just sort of following it, and it was leading me into different directions and different paths and journeys. I was trying to figure out an image to portray for, or to produce for my final semester painting, you know, the exit before graduation. And I came across this old photograph that was one of the only few photographs that's known to exist of the night of the Zoot Suit Riots in Los Angeles in 1943. Now, it really struck a chord with me again because I read this article, and this information was just baffling to me. I couldn't understand how this could have been in America in the 20th century, you know, not that long ago. And in a nutshell, it was a very brutal and erased history, an erased piece of Los Angeles history, an erased piece of American history. And there was about 200 American servicemen who, right on the brink of Pearl Harbor, right after Pearl Harbor, you know, there was a lot of hysteria. The Japanese Americans were being rounded up. Well, there was actually this sort of wave of intentional hysteria that was trying to be created in the city of Los Angeles towards Mexican Americans and the Zoot Suiters, Pachucos. We've all seen Cesar Martinez's paintings, you know, the flashy dressers with the hair, the Stacy Adams, the chains. You know, these guys took great pride in their clothes. And so there was about 200 American servicemen who marched in the streets of downtown Los Angeles and in East LA, armed with bats and clubs, chains and fists. And any Zoot Suiter that they came across, they stripped them naked, and you see the boy stripped naked, one with his coat thrown over his face, very violent image, and the other one, his friend, who's sort of sitting at his side. And the LAPD just sort of sat around and allowed it to happen. Any boy that hit a serviceman was automatically thrown in a paddy wagon and sent to jail. This lasted for 3 days before it was a full-blown race riot, and I knew immediately I had to do something in response to this piece of erased history. So this was the image that I came up with titled Kill the Pachuco Bastard, which was the chant of the servicemen as they marched into the streets. Now, this was literally the first piece of artwork in my career that I had produced that caused a lot of backlash, that received a lot of backlash, you know, not only from various communities, scholars, institutions even. And it couldn't have been better timing because 2001 had just occurred. 9/11 had just occurred about a year later after this was produced. And it was that same sort of sense of hysteria, you know, marketed hysteria, internal hysteria within the communities, within the cities, the nation, etc. So once I returned home from RISD, I sort of stayed on that path. You know, I allowed myself to just kind of step back and look at the world around me, and I allowed myself to respond to the world around me, you know, whether it was as a society, whether it was in my own backyard, in my community, in my family. All of the above was sort of a, you know, was a free-for-all. And so this was one of the earliest images that I created right after school titled, What's Your Profile? In response to racial profiling. Now, it was based off of, I felt, some of the profiling that was that I sort of encountered up in Providence, Rhode Island. You know, and again, being from Texas, we all know we literally are our own country. I mean, I thought the whole world was like Texas. I thought everybody ate tacos on Sunday for breakfast, or even for at midnight, you know. breakfast tacos, that is. But it was a real sort of culture shock when I went up there. And so it was a very important experience because it was such a shift in the way that I saw things, in the way that I thought, and in the way that I analyzed and then fleshed out all of these ideas. Also, right around that time, 1999, some of you may remember or be familiar with the case of Amadou Diallo Jr., who was a Haitian or Jamaican immigrant in Brooklyn that was walking towards his apartment, was pulled over by about six or seven unmarked undercover officers, and then he was shot 42 times. Some of the officers even reloaded their clips and continued shooting. When they found what he was reaching for in his pocket, he was taking out his ID. And so that, you know, I think in overall these images, again, are all sort of very pivotal experiences for me, experiences in terms of the images that I see on television, the images that I encounter as an American, the images that I encounter as a Mexican-American. So I've always felt like my work is a real sort of dissection of all of these things sort of layered one on top of the other. A response to that piece a few years later titled, My Chances Really Were a Million to One. So I think the important thing to sort of recognize is as this work starts to evolve and really kind of pick up speed and branch out, these ideas sort of remain the same, but at the same time, there's such a obvious variation, whether it be technically, through technique or medium, you know, everything from charcoal to pencil to oil to now the film formats and a few three-dimensional pieces, but also in terms of concepts. You know, I really strive as an artist to continuously challenge myself, to change things up, to reinvent myself. I mean, I think for me, reinvention is key as an artist because it's very easy to sort of forget and get comfortable with the subjects that you're used to and that you're good at. Many of you may be familiar with this face, my younger brother Daniel, who will probably be more famous at this point than I ever will be. I've been at HEB with this guy, and cashiers ask for his autograph. At the same time, I think that many of this work that becomes takes on this sort of universal format. You know, it sort of becomes, embodies all of us at some point. But at the same time, I like that I'm able to keep it very specific. You know, I think that's something that's very difficult to do, at least it is for me, but I know it's possible. You know, there's always seems to be, especially in the art world, this real need and this real sort of obsession with categorization. Everything has to be labeled and placed in a box. Everyone has to fit in a certain format or a certain genre of art making. And I've always felt like I've always sort of run away from that as fast as I could. I'm constantly trying to elude any kind of pigeonholing. It's not an easy thing to do, and not in terms of figuring it out technically, but it's not easy to do in terms of the actual of fitting into the art world, because one of the reactions that I find is many of the art critics, curators, patrons even, don't really know many times how to address such confrontational work. I find many times in the studio that it makes people uncomfortable, but I'm okay with that. You know, I think that as an artist, that's something that should be embraced. This was a series titled Made Men that I did probably in 2002, these very large-scale pastels on paper. And this was a very important series for me because it really was sort of this very refined, polished breakthrough of pinpointing exactly what I wanted to say at this point. I felt like the technique was where I wanted it to be, and the concepts, the clear thinking, was where I needed it to be. This isn't the first time, upstairs isn't the first time that I've used a Bob Dylan lyric as inspiration for a series of works. This was a series of works based after the song I Shall Be Released. So Each image takes a line from that song. Fast forwarding a few years, around 2007, I moved to Los Angeles and wound up remaining there for a few years. For me, I felt it was another real stepping stone in my career with my work, because the work really started to shift at an even more rapid speed. This was a piece in 2008 titled Burn Baby Burn. It was a lot different from me. You know, I remember feeling or facing a lot of turmoil with my work in the studio. It was probably one of the first times in my career that I sort of felt, art freeze. You know, I couldn't see my way through, and I couldn't really work in the studio. I was processing, I think, at this point. Everything was moving so fast with exhibitions and with the creation of this work constantly in the studio that everything came to a screeching halt. And one day I was looking out the view from my window, which was this view here, and I saw this vision. I saw the vision of moving to La La Land, you know, Hollywood, where all your dreams come true, and watching all of my hopes and dreams go up in flames. But at the same time, it was a very strong social political commentary for me. You know, I felt that the nation was facing great turmoil, you know, with the economy, with the wars. And so that's something that's very crucial in my work. It's always, again, you know, I'll keep emphasizing, it goes both ways for me. It's not enough to make it only a self-portrait, nor is it enough to make it only a social political commentary. And this is just a typical day at the park in Los Angeles. You know, it was a very exciting time for me. This city, this world, it was such a strange, chaotic place. You know, Los Angeles for me was this destination that always seemed to be hanging off the cliff. It always seemed to be teetering on the brink of chaos, whether it be earthquakes or fires, LAPD, gangs, I mean, you name it, it's there, Hollywood. And it was great for me. You know, it was really, I really got a lot out of it and saw a lot of things. And so after about 3 years there, then it started to flesh out. Seeing these things on television happening right down the street from where my studio was, actually being a part of some of these images or experiences, you know, was also a big key factor. And then the work started to really pour out. And I saw another real shift in the work. The work at this point was getting pretty monumental in scale. I was now thinking in terms of pinpointing even more my commentaries about the United States and this one exact moment in time. But I was realizing, looking back on the work that I had done previously to this, that I really relied a lot on history. You know, history for me was as crucial as the modern, as crucial as the present. And I was trying to blur the lines of the real and the non-real, the past and the present. And that sort of became key for me, and I decided to go down that path. By creating work through the use of realism, this sort of hyper-realism, I liked the sense and the idea of confusing the audience so much that they are actually convinced that I drew this from a photo, because I was standing behind this horse that was about to trample me. Or opposite of that, the audience member feeling like it was completely invented out of my own wacky imagination. And that distortion for me really started to take on a real crucial role in the work. We all know both of these guys. The King of King William. And so I wanted to share this with you because you get a sense of how I'm staging these things like a movie director in the studio. For me, film, again, has always been an extremely important influence. And many times in staging these models in the studio, I feel like a movie director. Now, I think it's important to note that when I stand before the easel or the sheet of paper, I can vividly see each one of these concepts, each one of these invented, fictitious narratives or characters or landscapes in full motion in my head. I can hear them. I can smell the way that landscape smells. I can hear the voices, the chanting, the backgrounds. And so they morph immediately from the staged into this whole other dimension. And again, I feel like I kept the monumental scale because those were the extensions from my days as a young muralist. As a muralist, I was able to realize that the captivation of a viewer driving down the freeway was some sort of spectacle like no other else. You know, it's one thing to hang something on a wall and have somebody pass by it in a museum setting, in a house, in an office, but to have somebody driving, to have an entire neighborhood view your work, I felt was really something that I was really obsessed with. And the work started getting larger and larger, and more dealers and framers started hating me because this stuff was almost impossible to frame. Some of them weighed up to 200 pounds with the glass. But, you know, I refused to compromise on the scale. This was a diptych titled Winner. So you get that real sense of, at this point, I've sort of minimalized and shed away all the things that I felt I had been used to at that point. Extremely detailed landscapes, settings, backgrounds. And I minimalized, I completely discarded the figure from the neck down. And it was a real honing in and a repolishing of conveying the concepts. The concepts now, I felt, were probably at this point a little bit more important than the actual portrait. So it was really this interaction with you, the viewer. You almost were staring at him, at this David staring at Goliath. So it becomes this sort of three-way interaction. But if you blink like he blinks, you'll miss his 2 seconds of glory. He's beaten, he's tattered, he's torn. And he sort of faces his own uncertainty. He faces his own destinies, his own fates. He reflects on the society that's placed him on this pedestal. And perhaps he's questioning if the fight was fixed all along. Perhaps he's questioning whether it was worth it after all. In 2009, I was getting ready to move back to San Antonio. And up to this point, you know, the boxers were really kind of dominating the work. And I was sort of sizzling out on the boxers a little bit. I had done the station show here at the McNay. And I felt like I didn't want to give up the idea and the relationship I had with these masculine icons, these tragic male icons. And so I started exploring other departments almost of these portraits, and I remembered the soldiers. You know, I felt like it had already been a number of years since I was a kid that I had really explored the idea of the soldiers. And so this was a diptych titled, I'm Your Brother from Another Mother. And so there's always this sort of twisted, underlying sense of humor in some of this work. But at the same time, you know, perhaps it's for yours or my own sanity, that these things, that you find some sort of hope in them, that you find some sort of revelation or some sort of doorway to carry on. And so we see these two individuals who have slain each other, and they're realizing, even though they're complete opposites, as opposite as night and day, that they weren't so different after all. Perhaps, like they had been told and convinced by others, that they were enemies, perhaps they were brothers in the end, a little too late, as they sort of, reflective of old Italian opera posters, in their last dying breath, they sing to each other, I'm your brother from another mother. And so at this point, I came home, and I saw my dear friend John Holt, who I grew up with since about the age of 9 or 10. John and I were the best of friends and like brothers, did everything together, spent the summers together running around, playing basketball, looking at girls, talking on the phone. I mean, we were buddies. And When I came home in September of 2009, John had just completed his first tour in Iraq as a combat medic. And I asked John, I told him about the series that I was doing, and he was more than enthused to participate. And he was constantly telling me, man, you're so lucky. I wish I could just sit around and draw all day. And then he'd always finish it by saying, go get a real job. And I explained to him that I was working on this small series of sort of sketchbook studies in the studio in Los Angeles. And they were supposed to be these snippets of everyday connections for me, a response to just sort of everyday faces, everyday experiences. And it was going to be like an ongoing sketchbook diary. And so John was going to be the first one, but I showed him the images of I'm Your Brother from Another Mother and explained it to him. And he liked it, and I said, so I may take your image, and I'm thinking about doing a war series and continuing it. And he said, go for it. And so I had John dress up in full combat gear, and it was a very fascinating thing because I was walking him in his old neighborhood up and down the streets, so there was people watering their lawns, just kind of waving, and other old ladies that you could see peeking through the blind, like wondering what's going on, and cars honking and giving him a thumbs up. And we spent all day together. And I photographed him. We went to our old high school, Burbank High School, walked around the yard there and walked back. And then at the end of the day, John and I went for a drink, and it was great. You know, John, I hadn't seen him, even though I hadn't seen him in years, it was one of those rare experiences with rare friends where you pick up right where you left off. And we had a good time, and he was the same old John that I knew. Nothing had changed, except when I asked him over a drink about his experiences as a combat medic, his demeanor completely changed. I saw this veil sort of fall over his face. His personality changed, and I knew that he wasn't the same. He wasn't the same sort of innocent kid that we had all known growing up, which was one of the reasons that he was so liked. And when I left the next day, I went back to Los Angeles and I created this image about a week later. And I sent it to John and he immediately responded, damn, who is that good-looking guy? And that was so classic John. He thought he was John Travolta. And these were some of the images that I took of John. And so I thought I would share this with you because you get to see the real sort of direct connection and link of how these images are sort of envisioned and how they give birth to the 2D images, you know, the things that appear on canvas and on paper. And so there's a large painting titled John. And when I was doing the image off and on for about 2 years, you know, it was a very difficult image for me to produce. Not only because I was still trying to find closure with my dear friend, but also because John, the portrait of John, had taken on a larger-than-life personality, a larger-than-life meaning. To me, he sort of became the representation of all Johns, especially today. Originally, this image changed in and out for over 2 years, and I can honestly say that this is the only image in my entire career up to this point that has taken me so long to produce. It was an image that I really fought with. It was an image that I really sort of wasn't sure if I could continue or complete, but I'm glad that I did. And for me, it literally became this sort of universal symbol. It's the narrative of this young man trying to find his way back. Perhaps he's fallen off the path. The fogs of war behind him are about to drown him out and erase him. And then I remembered where I started, this idea of erasure. And for me, it was an extremely strong protest against the erasure of not only the troops in the 2 ongoing wars, but it was an erasure of the troops that are struggling with PTSD, who are not acknowledged by the Department of Defense as casualties of war, who are not acknowledged as combat-related injuries or deaths by the Pentagon. And I saw it as a very unfair, a very important image to convey, because when the audience, in my head, when the audience views this image, it really sets into mind perhaps a series of questions for the viewer. I think most viewers are going to think the obvious and assume that this is a portrait of a soldier who is in combat, but it's actually quite opposite. I never knew John in combat. I didn't stand by his side in combat, so I have no idea what he was like in combat. To me, this is John here at home. One of the small, subtle, but most important hints at that narrative is the American flag patch. John, as well as other soldiers that I've read, wore a black flag patch in combat, and John chose to wear the red, white, and blue patch when he was here at home. So it's suggestive of this individual fighting here at home. Again, you know, this image or this experience for me was, like for many of us, was a very traumatic experience, something that I will never forget. But nonetheless, it was a way to really give tribute to my friend John. It was really a way for me to once again reflect on where I stand with my role as an artist. When John passed away in 2009, by 2010, a few weeks later, I was home in January, moved back to San Antonio, and this was the stuff that immediately spit out of me. This whole series that Lyle saw in the studio titled Excerpts for John. It was probably one of the most personal series of works that I had created because, again, it was so haunting for me to remember. It was a very surreal morning at Fort Sam. It was like something out of a movie. It was very somber and very quiet and very cold. I tried to recreate how I remembered that morning in the series of images. One of the things that I did, I recorded an entire audio file of that whole procession. And so you hear the rain, you hear the horse hooves from the casket and the carriage, you hear the footsteps, and you hear the weeping. And that's how I found the imagery for this set of works. The actual procession, like Stations of the Cross, that I had experimented with before in terms of boxing. But for me, this went beyond that. It becomes a modern-day procession. A few more of the images from America's Finest, piece titled Requiem, which crippled my hand for about 3 or 4 weeks working in the studio. How I decided to paint or to draw 2,500 feathers, who knows? I mean, I joke with Lyle that in the next life I'm coming back as a complete minimalist. And I'd like to mention also that if you have passed by this flag, many people sort of walked by it, assuming that I had just folded a real American flag and placed it there. But it's not that. It's actually hand-drawn on canvas and rendered to look like stitched stars on there. Again, the sort of idea of a black flag in protest.
That was Vincent Valdez, recorded at the McNay Art Museum last month. You can listen to the full version at tpr.org under Hear SA. This has been the Newsmaker Hour. Special thanks to the McNay staff this week. I'm Paul Flav. Thanks for listening.